This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
We've been looking forward to a conversation with this man the entire season, Dave, and I am glad we have finally nailed him down. He has finally agreed. Our people got to his people. We were able to work out and broker a deal, and he is now with us on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. He is the voice of the TV voice of your Seattle Kraken. John Forslund is with us. How are you, sir?
I'll tell you what, it was one tough negotiation, but we got through it.
I'm glad we were able to come to terms.
Yeah.
Hey, John, first off, I've got to tell you that is a hockey novice at best. You fit right into the history of voices in this city, which is very, very rich. And this is not to blow smoke, but, you know, Dave and I talk about it all the time. You know, and we'll get into the particulars of the season, but the history here from baseball to football, you can go to basketball with Kevin Colabro and Dave Niehaus and Bob Blackburn and Pete Gross and Rick Riz, and I can just go on and on and on. You are fantastic. You for a hockey novice, you make the game incredibly compelling and interesting, and you are really, really good at what you do. I just have to say that.
Well, thank you so much. That means a lot to me because I'm aware of where I'm at. I'm aware of what has happened here in this market with other sports. And now that we have, you know, this opportunity, I think I said when I took the job, my goal is to earn the trust of everybody, and it's going to be a continuing thing. But I appreciate you saying that because there's some rich history here with everything else, and we're just trying to find our niche with the Kraken.
Boy, after that glowing introduction from Bob, John, you should have just said,
goodbye, everybody.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
We really enjoyed listening to you. Let me ask you this. As far as a new fan base, you know, do you change your broadcasting style, the things you use? I was joking around. I got all these fancy hockey terms like odd man rush, but Bob and I are kind of, we're new to the game, and so is it a little bit different for you as far as your broadcast style?
Just a little bit, you know, because you have to keep in mind the people who enjoy hockey, who have followed hockey for years, and there's plenty of those people here, and there's plenty of new people here. So you have to strike a balance, and I've already been through this, you know, way back when I started and we moved the franchise from Hartford to Raleigh in my 23 years with the Hurricanes. At the very beginning, there was some education that was really needed. I mean, that was really virgin territory. Here, because of the junior hockey presence, the history of Seattle pro hockey, and just, you know, in a major city, there's some awareness of the NHL. You have to be careful, but you never stop educating. When I pick spots within broadcasts where I think things need to be explained. And even for people who have followed the game for a number of years, sometimes you'll get, gee, thanks for explaining that because I never knew. So the worst question is one that's never asked, right? So people will ask, and as we go along, if there's something that's what's great about social media, if there's something they don't understand, they can just reach out and ask me, and I'll explain it.
Hey, John, as far as the season goes, I mean, an expansion franchise, it feels like the expectations were really, really built up by what happened in Las Vegas. And, you know, there were a lot of things that were different this time around, and this feels disappointing to a lot of people because Vegas goes to the Stanley Cup Finals, and here's a team that's, you know, just ended a 9-game losing streak. I'm guessing you went into it with more of a realistic attitude about what to expect, but has the season gone maybe a little bit further down the wrong way than you anticipated at this point?
Yeah, I expected more. I thought they would be in the neighborhood of a playoff spot, if not in the playoffs. I thought the roster was good enough, just based on my opinion and where the rest of the division was. But I think what no one saw coming were the three teams in California and how well L.A., San Jose, and Anaheim have performed. They've performed above a level that everyone expected, which has made it difficult. Vegas, after somewhat of a sluggish start, is where everybody thought they would be at the top of the division. And then you've got Edmonton and Calgary and Vancouver, you know, and you could argue those points there. I'm just surprised that the Kraken haven't been consistent enough to hang in there around 500. And I'm surprised they had a six-game losing skid at the early stages of this season. I'm surprised they're just coming off a nine-game winless stretch. I thought based on their personnel and their structure and their goaltending, you know, they would be better defensively than they've shown. I still think it's a tough season. It's a tough one to read because of all the different COVID circumstances. Every team's gone through it, right, guys? I mean, that's not, you know, to give the Kraken an out here. But the Kraken's lineup with this COVID thing hasn't been the same from the very beginning of the season. Some teams like Anaheim, the last 10 games, they've gone through a real battle with this thing. But prior to it, they didn't have much of it in their locker room. COVID's been in and around the Kraken since the beginning of the year, and to be fair to Dave Haxtell and his staff, they really haven't had a set lineup at all. So it's hard to read what this is really about, but I think they could have played better, and that's the only thing I look at right now, and I'm just hoping that they can, you know, close this season out in a strong way, continue to be very good at home and do what they did on Monday, entertain these fans that have been really loyal and really excitable from the very beginning of the year, and improvement so you can look ahead and see what the future holds.
Hey, John, during the losing streak there, we heard some frustration from Jared McCann. He's talking about enough is enough. And, you know, I'm just wondering, with a franchise team like this, you've got a bunch of guys from other teams coming together and then, you know, just new faces and everything. Has that been a problem as far as, you know, finding a leader, a voice of this team? And my second question would be that who would be the guys that are starting to emerge as leaders on this team?
Yeah, that's a great word, emerge, right? Leaders emerge, and McCann's one of those. And he's been a guy that I don't think was given that opportunity elsewhere, certainly not in Pittsburgh. But here, it's been like a steady progression, and that's been good to see, fun to watch. The thing about hockey is that it's a game based in trust and trust on the ice. And when you don't have continuity and you have all these different individuals coming together, you'd like to say, geez, okay, guys, be a team after a few weeks of training camp, be a team with your new coach and his philosophies. And I think where the head scratching comes in is when they struggle. And when teams struggle, guys try to do more than they can do. And because of that, they stretch themselves out physically, mentally, and they lose the trust. And that's the one thing I've observed, you know, watching this team is that's been a hard thing to get to, where they play with cohesion, where they have a set crew. The lines haven't stayed together very long. The defense pairings have been mixed up all the time. Some of it based because of the roster and the COVID and injuries, and other reasons because of their play. So until you get to that place, until you get that built-in trust among the players, it's hard to see a real team emerge, but it's starting to happen. And I've liked the week they had coming off the pause. They had a long week of practice, and starting in Denver last week, aside from the game against LA, they played pretty well enough to win most of these games, and they finally were able to do it against Chicago on Monday. So be interested to see what happens this week starting tomorrow.
Hey, John, Philip Grubauer was a big acquisition, and people were excited. He was one of the three finalists for the Vezina Trophy last year. It's not been his season this year. It's not been good. Right. And I'm just wondering, how much of that do you put on him versus, you know, when we've talked about it before, some of our more educated hockey fans will text in and go, Bob, it's not all him. It's the defenseman he had playing in front of him last year versus this year. It's completely different. How much of that do you put on who's playing in front of him versus just his own personal struggles?
Well, it's a tough comparison because he was on an elite team, right? And he comes to an expansion team. So, yeah, of course he was on a better team. And, of course, because he was a Vezina finalist, as one of the top three goalies in the league, he played at that level. Let me just start with this. Philip Grubauer is an excellent goalie, okay? Has he played like one? No. His numbers are not very good. His general stats aren't any good. His analytical numbers aren't any good. But at times he has played well. And what I will say about watching his season is this. I thought he was dialed in at the beginning. I thought Chris Drieger's injury at the outset of the season, the very beginning, that first five-game road trip, put him in a spot where Grubauer was playing probably too much. And then the team started to, have their troubles, defensively. And because of that, you know, he was really being put into a tough spot. And I'll go back to the middle of November, the last time Chicago was here. We showed the highlights of that game. And after that loss to Chicago, if you recall, he didn't get to start against his old team, Colorado. And Driedger played that game. And there was some questioning going on. Even Dave Haxtell said, you know, we need to get better, a save in this situation. It's kind of an indirect shot at the goalie. I thought it was too early for that. And I thought he started to put some pressure on himself. And if you look at the highlights of that first Chicago game, it had nothing to do with Grubauer. It had everything to do with how they were playing through the middle of the ice defensively. And again, what their defensive structure was. It wasn't any good at all. And that's where they were during that six-game losing streak. And then I think Grubauer put a lot of pressure on himself, started overplaying pucks, overplaying angles, letting in soft goals, and then it's a perfect storm, a negative perfect storm. I think he's going to bounce back. I've been watching him closely since they returned. His work habits in that week of practice were very good. I thought he deserved a better fate in Denver last Monday. Played really well. The Dallas game, the team got off to a bad start, but he battled his way through that one. And then he was excellent against Marc-Andre Fleury, who was absolutely stupendous for Chicago here Monday afternoon. So hopefully he can get on a run. But he is an excellent goalie. I'll stand behind that, and I believe there's a lot better stuff ahead with him. There has to be because they've invested so much in him.
Hey, John, as far as, the future and going forward with the GM, Ron Francis, we got a chance to interview him. I just love talking to him. He just seemed like a really solid guy. But as far as, how much do you know about him, and what would you say about the job that he's done so far in this adversity here they're facing?
I know two things about Ronnie. I've known him since 1990. Okay, that's how far back we go. When he played with the Hartford Whalers, when I first joined that organization, then he was traded to Pittsburgh as soon as I got there. I got to see the aftermath of what that was like, and it really destroyed the Hartford franchise by sending him to Pittsburgh. And then he came back as a free agent, and we signed him in Raleigh, and I got to really get to know him as a player. Then he moved on into coaching, moved on into management. I got to watch all of that. And there's two things about him. Number one, he has a plan, and it's based on a lot of hockey IQ and intellect of where he's coming from. And the other thing that he has is he's got a stubbornness about him that he's going to stick with it. And he knows the long-range plan for this franchise, and he doesn't really have a panic level. So I think he's disappointed. I think he's really disappointed the way this has gone down, but I think he's confident that he can build it the right way. And I've seen him do it with the Hurricanes, and the lion's share of what the Hurricanes have right now is a top team in the league. A lot of the grunt work was done by Ron as the GM there and his scouting staff in terms of drafting and developing. And that's going to be what's really important for the Kraken moving forward. It would have been nice to have a magical season and have everything fall into place and get to the playoffs and have some chemical equation work that Vegas had in their first year. And that would have been unbelievable. But I think where Ronnie wants to be with this team is get them really viable in a couple of seasons, to the point where you get to year four and five and you're there. You're legitimately talking about deep runs every year in the playoffs. You're legitimately talking about winning a Stanley Cup. Every team can talk about it, but how many teams realistically have a chance at doing it? And I think that's what he'll keep in mind. And he's got the courage of his convictions. He's going to dig in, and he's going to do it to a fault. And that's why I think he's a strong manager. And I think they made the right choice with this guy.
Speaking with the TV voice of your Seattle Kraken, John Forslund, here with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. And John, Brandon Tanev was a guy that fans immediately were drawn to for various reasons. Some of it just about his picture, his picture that he team picture. I mean, he's a guy with a personality, seems to be a good player. I'm not going to pretend to have followed his career, but I'm curious just how big of a loss was that to the team. We know how the fans feel about him. But to the team, how much of a loss was what he brought to the ice in his energy?
Well, that's the thing. It's his energy, and it's a built-in energy that's real, and it doesn't vary from game to game, shift to shift. He's always been like that. I've always described him, and I think I did at the expansion draft when we had the big day there in July, is that, you know, this guy is organized chaos when he gets on the ice, and you people are going to love him. You're going to grow to love Brandon Tanev, and they have. So he's arguably the most popular player in a short period of time. He was having a career season. But his energy level lifts the team, and hockey is a game of momentum. It swings back and forth. And when you're in a lull, you need somebody to go out there and stir the pot. You need somebody to go out there and make a big hit and get the crowd behind you again. And he's able to do that. And he's able to maintain the energy of a game. And I watched him last year. I covered him pretty deep with NBC, you know, with Pittsburgh, and watched the kind of playoff he had, especially against the New York Islanders. He was one of their best players. So you got to get him back to full health, get him back in the mix. You can build around a player like that. He's a great, you know, lower half of the forward group guy that can kill penalties and do a variety of different things. But he's got a charisma about him that's just like his publicity shot, right? It's just intriguing to watch him. He's even fun to watch in the pregame warm-up, and I know the fans have enjoyed that too. So they miss him. They miss Jaden Schwartz, who they signed for some real built-in scoring, and hopefully he's back in a couple of weeks. But those are just the hurdles they're going through in this challenging first season.
Who's a guy, John, that you think is underappreciated, that fans don't necessarily hear his name very often, but that you've noticed broadcasting these games that is maybe a little underrated?
Adam Larson. Adam Larson, to me, is their best defenseman. He's a quiet guy in terms of the way he plays, how he presents himself. You look at his minutes, you look at his tough minutes that he plays shorthanded, the block shots, the physicality, and the fact that he doesn't make too many mistakes, and he makes it look easy. And sometimes as a defenseman, they're kind of like offensive linemen. If you don't notice them, they're doing a heck of a job, and Adam's that kind of player. He's a terrific athlete because his stamina, it's going to be tested too. You know, I know you guys know the new schedule came out today, and these postponed games have been rescheduled in February. Kraken, along with every other team in the league, are going to go on a run here where they play basically every other day for about 3.5 months. And, because of his capacity as an athlete, he's able to play in the high 20s every night in terms of his minutes. And a lot of those minutes are against top matchups, top players on the other side, and shorthanded situation. So I've really enjoyed watching him. I think he's a terrific pro, and he's a player that kind of keeps everything together back there. So I've enjoyed him, and he doesn't get a lot of press because he doesn't put a lot of points on the board. He's had some big moments, but it's just the way he plays. You know, it's not going to really jump at you all the time, but if you watch closely, he's a very important player.
Hey, John, give us an impression of the fan, the building, first of all, your thoughts on the building. Dave and I went there for the Foo Fighters concert, you know, to open that thing up, and we're just blown away by it. But just your thoughts on the building and the fan base. I mean, a new fan base, again, we've talked about it. A lot of them, you know, hockey is a new sport. People very excited, season tickets selling out almost immediately. What's the experience been like for you as a seasoned hockey guy out there?
Well, I love the building, right? And it's very selfish because most of my opinions that are favorable of these arenas is based on where the broadcast location is. Yeah. So our view of the game is exceptional. And my favorite building in the league is in Montreal. And at Bell Center in Montreal, it's a gondola-type situation where you hang right over the rink and you can feel the game. I get the same feeling in Climate Pledge Arena. But I there's two things here. The fans have been very good to me, very welcoming, which I appreciate in a brand new place. I'd never been to Seattle in my life, took the job without seeing the city, you know, because of the pandemic and all that, all those things. But the fans, the excitement, and I think Monday afternoon was perfect because the first afternoon game, there were a lot of kids in the building. Everyone knows where the Kraken are at statistically and where they're headed and the challenges they've had this season, but you would never know it. You'd never know it at the game. I watched it back, you know, I watched our telecast back, and you would never know it watching that game. You would think they're jockeying for a playoff spot, or it was a playoff game. That energy is real. I think it's part of the city. It's an outsider's view of the fans here, just being a, you know, great NFL fan over the years and watching what's developed with the 12s. And I mean, I go so far back. I remember, you know, Freddie Brown and Gus Williams and Jack Sikma and all that stuff. And just watching that from afar, from the East Coast, and watching those NBA finals, specifically against the Washington Bullets at the time. And just being enamored by how loud it appeared to be, and kind of this building, which the only thing we have is the roof, right? So it's just kind of neat, and I'm just happy to be part of it. And I think we're going to continue to grow here, and I think the team will take on the identity of the fans, and vice versa. I think that we're starting to see that now. We're starting to see how the Kraken Nation shows up and what they're all about, and the team is going to have to give them more reason to even get more excited here.
John, really quick, how do you do it? I sit next to Rabel in the broadcast, radio broadcast for the Seahawks, and typically all I can ever get out as the play's going is like a grunt or something like that. And I mean, you're calling, I mean, these guys are coming on the ice and, you know, line changes and, you know, how did you, were you a little kid that was like practicing with a wooden spoon, or, you know, what, tell us about your development.
Yeah, I think it was, it was 1970. So I would have been 8 years old, and the Bruins won the Stanley Cup, and Bobby Orr scored that iconic goal in overtime where he got tripped by a St. Louis defenseman, scored the goal, went flying through the air. And I remember exactly where I was, and I remember exactly who was calling the game on CBS that Sunday afternoon. It was Mother's Day. It was a great Dan Kelly. And if you're familiar with hockey, you know who I'm talking about. If you're not, then, you know, think of Vin Scully, think of whomever you want to think about, because that's how great Dan Kelly was as a hockey announcer. And anyway, it was his cadence and what he did that day, and I just started to develop this hobby of calling games off the television like many broadcasters did when they were kids. But my dad was my color man. And we used to pull in all the Bruin games. I lived 90 miles west of Boston, Springfield, Massachusetts. We had an old parabolic antenna with a booster from Sears, and we could get the games, and his buddies would come around and sit there. We'd turn the sound down, and I would do the games. And we recorded them, and that's where it started. And I don't know how. I just thank God that I've been able to do this for a long time. And still love it, and still have the energy and the passion, and I hope it never goes away.
I love that your dad was the color man. Now, did you refer to each other as dad and son on the broadcast, or would you go first?
No,
names?
No, I called him Ralph by his name. Okay. It was the only time I was allowed to do that. And but I fired him when I was 16. I fired him because I didn't feel he was preparing enough, so we had to get rid of him. So
oh, that is awesome.
And make a change. My mom didn't want to do it, though. She was down the hall in another room because she hated the sport. So that's the way it is.
Oh, that is so good. Hey, John, it's a pleasure. I'm glad we were able to catch up with you finally. And as I said, you got a couple of fans here and on this show. You do a tremendous job. We really appreciate it. And hopefully things turn around. We get a chance to talk to you when this thing's on the upswing.
Any time, I appreciate it, and I really, really thank you for everything you said. I really appreciate that. It means a lot. Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much, John. There you go. There's the TV voice of your Seattle Kraken, John Forslund, who is really, really good. He just, even if you're not a hockey fan or a hockey expert, he just keeps you dialed in. He is really, really good. And if you missed any of that conversation, you can just head to the podcast page at 710sports.com. You can also search Wyman and Bob on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast, and make sure you just hit subscribe. That's all you got to do. You don't ever have to worry about it again after that. All right, coming up.
Or you can go to Apple Wallet.
Apple Wallet, that's where
Lefko
keeps his show. Yeah, he puts his podcast in his Apple Wallet. All right, one more underachiever or overachiever to get to, and it might be the most difficult one to label. That is coming up next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
All right, we've been doing this throughout the show today, taking a look at some key members of the Seahawks roster and labeling them overachiever, underachiever. This is a tough one right here, Dave. This is...
Yeah.
I'm still not even sure what I'm going to say about him.
You know what? That's so funny you said that, because I was coming back and I looked at it, obviously, and, well, not so obviously. Sometimes I jump ahead because I didn't look at the show sheet.
You're a guy who reads the last page of a book before you get to the beginning.
It's in case I die, Bob.
You forward to the end of a movie to see how it ends, and then you start it over. Watch everything that precedes it. But
no, but I was thinking the same thing. Like, how do you answer this one?
DK Metcalf is who we're talking about right now. And I feel like I've got to apply the same logic to him that we did with Carlos Dunlap, who we both called an overachiever, because a lot of what was happening with him in lack of production was out of his control.
Right.
He had a half a sack through 12 weeks. We talked about in two games combined, he had 11 snaps of the football. I mean, there were just, you look at his percentages throughout the season, and it's just inexcusable how he was being used. So it made no sense whatsoever. So we called him an overachiever. With DK, he had 75 catches on 129 targets, 967 yards, 12 touchdowns, fourth most in the NFL. He was targeted five times or less in five games this year. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, all right, well, how does that work? Is that him not getting open? Because I feel like there are a lot of times we saw him open, Russ just didn't see him, or the pass rush got to Russ, he's scrambling the other direction from him. So that's sort of hard to tell, like, you know, why was he targeted so few times? But he was also dealing with a foot injury that was happening through the majority of the season. Every week we'd look at that injury report we'd get from the Seahawks, limited participation, did not participate, you know, the practice report. And he was on there almost every single week. And we'll see what comes of the foot injury and how serious it was or wasn't. But I'm kind of leaning toward overachieve based on the number of touchdowns he came up with in the limited targets or catches that he got in, again, games where he had five times or less in five games and very little to no practice dealing with that foot injury.
Yeah. I guess I don't give as much credit for, you know, that, to me, that's just part of your job is playing through the pain. And I admire him for that. And I don't think we heard a whole lot of complaining from him, did we?
No, we saw, you know, we see him very animated on the sidelines.
Yeah.
We saw that, and people will read into it what they want to read into it. He's mad at Russ. He's mad at Pete. He's mad at Waldron. He's mad, you know, we don't know. He never said anything publicly about any of it. I didn't hear a word of him being, you know, this is nonsense. We got to get the ball to me. I need more catch. I need more touch. Whatever. I don't know what he said on the sideline, but publicly, we never heard a word about that.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna go with underachieve, and here's just strictly based on. I thought that there were times where, I don't think he's a diva, but I think there were times where his body language wasn't good. I know they overdid it. I think they overdid it, and I think he's a really good player, and I don't think he's going to be any kind of a problem. But he got the same number of targets last year, and he had 75 catches, and almost 350 yards less than he did last year with the same targets. Mm-hmm. So now, do I remember him dropping a bunch? Not really. I mean, I don't
think
like
that was more
like
of a problem last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, let's see. I'm trying to think about, well, because last year he was also targeted 129 times and he had 83 catches, so eight more than he did this year. But again, last year he had 1,300 yards. This year, 967. So, but the touchdowns are up there. But I guess I'll say underachieve. If we have to choose one or the other, and Lefko, you know, makes the rules, so we have to follow him.
What are you going to say? He played? He had a season? That's not fun.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, you got to think about it. Yeah. Dig into it.
No, I'll say like Pete Carroll. I'll say he got through it.
I mean, I look at it and go, production-wise, he was. I mean, the only receivers that had more touchdowns than him, Cooper Kupp, Ja'Marr Chase had one more than him, and Mike Evans. He had more touchdown catches than Davante Adams.
That's pretty
good.
He
didn't have as many total catches, but touchdown catches, he had more. So it's in Stephon Diggs and Justin Jefferson. He had Travis Kelce, all these guys who are big-time targets. He had more touchdowns than all of those guys.
Yeah.
So I'm giving him credit for the production considering the physical limitation and target limitation, I guess, in some of those games. Five targets or less in five games. I'll go with overachieve.
All right. Well, I give no sympathy whatsoever to people with a hurt foot.
He wasn't practicing, man. I don't know. We'll see what goes on. You gave
it was easier for him.
To Trey Brown, who only played in five games and started three.
Yeah, but he had a patella tendon thing.
Oh, it's an injury.
This was just my foot was sore.
I don't know. We don't know what's wrong with his foot. We don't know if he's going to have surgery. We don't know anything about the foot.
Can you imagine if he was listening to this, he'd be like, what an ass this guy is.
Yeah.
Who does he think he is?
You know what Malik McDowell would say? Injuries is injuries.
Bob, that might be a new T-shirt. A new T-shirt idea. Instead of taxes is taxes.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kind of giving him a hard time. I guess, like, yeah, I mean, that's just part of being a pro. But, you know, if we have to pick one or the other, and again, I blame Lefko. This is like when we talk about Russell Wilson and you blame Mark Rogers, the agent. I'm just going to blame Lefko. He's forcing me to say underachieve. So, but yeah, I wonder what about the texters? Haven't checked in with the texters here on this one.
Let's see what they're saying. I haven't looked either. I'm going to guess I'm in the minority because there seemed to be a lot of sentiment about, oh, he's a diva, he's a this, he's a that. Let's see here. There were so many throws to DK that were just absolutely terrible throws from Russ.
See,
that, as the 206.
He's right about that. They were bad.
Yeah, you do get credited for a target when sometimes they're just throwing it in your direction 15 feet over your head.
Right.
You know?
Right.
425 says DK drops with Russell bad throws to him, mostly didn't help him. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't. They're not picking over or underachieving. Did DK overachieve or underachieve, considering all the circumstances? We'll ask that question, and you guys can text in your responses to that. 421-3776, 421-ESPN, powered by Mac and Jack's Brewing Company.
Injuries is injuries.
Injuries is injuries, Dave. That's what Malik is saying from a jail cell somewhere currently. Is he in jail, by the way, or is he out? I can't even remember if he got out on bail. But anyway, so you guys text in whether you thought DK over or underachieved this past season. Meanwhile, what should the first priority be for the Seahawks during this defensive coordinator search? We'll talk about that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob, brought to you by Angel of the Winds Casino Resort on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Got some texts rolling in on our question, Dave, about whether DK overachieved or underachieved. It's actually kind of split.
Going?
It's kind of split, actually. DK didn't high point the ball well. Foot may have played a factor in that, limiting his ability to jump, underperformed. He needs to work on going after the ball instead of waiting for it. So I guess they're saying underachieved. I-Test says underachieved. Stats say overachieved. I say over. Position is too dependent upon quarterback and game plan. So he's saying overachieved.
Well, that's welcome to being a wide receiver, and that's why they get frustrated and throw temper tantrums.
Yeah, 253, DK overachieved because Russ must have led him out of bounds on the sideline by overthrowing him two dozen times.
Oh, two dozen.
I don't know if it was that many, but it did happen. It certainly was. I mean, again, you technically are targeted, but you're not in a position to make a catch inbound. So DK definitely overachieved, says the 425. Had so many bad throws from Russ. If Russ had been on target, he would have, and it just refreshed on me. Where the heck did it go? Oh, if Russ would have been on target, he would have equaled or exceeded last year's results. So there you go.
That's a good, you know, I mean, if that's a tough argument to shoot down because, you know, Russ, he was just different. He just was, and it seemed like, you know, I thought more disturbing to me were some of the decisions that we saw from Russ, and we have high standards for him. I mean, we expect, you know, 70% completion percentage, but, you know, there was a few times where he missed guys that were open, and then, yeah, I think it was very obvious that it was, and I don't know how much of it was physical and how much of it was mental. I mean, only a quarterback could tell you that, and you know, Jake Heap says that, you know, that finger's pretty important where the ball comes off. So
yeah. And then 206 says DK only had one drop this season, according to Pro Football Reference. Mm. Or Focus. I don't know which where they determine that, but all right, one drop. I think, yeah, I mean, it's obviously incredibly dependent on everything going right. Success at that position, right? A good throw, the line blocking long enough for you to get into your route, the quarterback making the right decision, making the right throw, what have you.
So the receivers running routes,
yeah,
pull the
yeah.
coverage away, you know. Yeah.
So it's I don't know. It's interesting. It's much more split than I thought it would be, though, and people leaning toward overachieved, which is interesting. Meanwhile, Dave, moving on to the search that will continue for the defensive coordinator and what should be a priority. Had a couple people weigh in on that. Matt Hasselbeck, speaking with Mike Salk, feels like Pete's going to want somebody who tailors the defense to the players they've got.
I don't know that X's and O's is really what I think Pete will go for. I think it's going to be a little bit more the person, the teaching, the technique, the experience, how quickly and moldable and adaptable are they to in-game adjustments, how moldable are they to the personnel. Quite honestly, the personnel in Seattle is a little unique. You know, you have one safety that is really a great pass rusher, but that's about it. So you need to get him, you know, you need to get him pass rushing and not stuck in man coverage too much. You know what I mean? Stuff like that.
I typically agree with Matt Hasselbeck, but I don't on that. He was just basically saying that he's a good pass rusher, but that's it. I just think, you know, Jamal Adams is a really good football player.
Yeah, I think he's a really physical player. I think he's a good tackler. I think the only area he really struggles in is in pass coverage. And, you know, most of that is about hanging on to the ball when it hits him.
Well, he got beat a few times, you know, and I always talk about the, what's his name, Tyler?
Higbee.
You know, and that was pretty bad. To me, yeah, it's a 50-50 matchup with a strong safety and a tight end, but if you're the best safety in football, you cover that.
Yeah.
So I think he could definitely use some work in that regard. But then, you know, I don't want to say don't put him in that position because you have to have him cover sometimes. I mean, he's not going to put his hand in the dirt and rush the passer every time. But yeah, then I think people thought maybe, and I thought the whole defense, but the cutback run by Derrick Henry, where I think Quandre, he just had a huge hallway there where he had to, you know, try to come up and make a tackle. But a lot of people thought that that he was maybe a little bit too aggressive. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about Jamal Adams. So, yeah, there was a few times. I understand. I think what happened was when he signed that big deal, everybody's expectations went through the roof. And, you know, if he didn't have 9.5 sacks, then he was going to be a failure.
Well, his expectations were through the roof, remember?
Wasn't it 13 sacks?
It was 12 sacks.
12 and 5.
Or I might have said 12.5. 12 or 12.5, and he said 5 picks.
Yeah.
So
he got 2.
He's got high expectations of himself.
Yeah. 2 interceptions, no sacks, but... Yeah, I think he's a good player, and people overreacted to him, I thought. And,
well, you know, it's like they didn't watch how he was being used, though.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, he wasn't up on the line like he was.
Yeah, I mean, here and there, but we were reading off percentages during the season about, you know, how often he was rushing the passer versus the year previous. There, every once in a while, we get those numbers out there, and they weren't even close. So. No. It wasn't that he was never doing it, but in comparison to the previous season when he was this high octane impact player, it was night and day. So I'm sure he made those predictions to us before he knew what the game plan was and the way they were going to use him.
Well, and then in our next cut, we'll hear from Mark. But I thought if you asked me, like, who did they cater the defense to last year? I would say if there was one player, it was Bobby Wagner.
Yeah.
To me, I feel like they were going to cover him up and let him run around and make tackles everywhere. And, you know, I think it came at the expense maybe of a couple of other players. But I understand wanting to cater to Bobby. But I think, you know, his play is, you know, as far as ball skills, everything has just always been fantastic. Rushing the passer. But as far as Bobby's physicality, it's dropped off in the last few years. So that was their, I think solution was to cover him up, let him run around, make tackles, and maybe that came at the expense of other players.
You brought up Mark Schlereth, who's on with us every single Tuesday, and he was with us yesterday. Great conversation with him, which is available for you on the podcast page if you missed it. Check it out at 710sports.com. But he talked about whoever the defensive coordinator is, what they need to do, and it sounds obvious, but it didn't feel like that's what was happening last season, is maximize the strengths of what you have to work with and minimize the weaknesses.
How do we maximize our players' potential? And then two, how do we minimize or mitigate our weaknesses? And those are the kind of two perspectives that I always look at. And, you know, your former defensive coordinator, Dan Quinn, it was interesting talking to him just a couple of weeks ago when he was talking about, hey, one of the things we've done is we've taken that kind of Seattle cover three defense, that match cover three, and we've really run a lot more man-to-man, but we have zoned the middle routes. Like, we've zoned off the shallow crosses. We've zoned off a bunch of, because that's where we're getting hurt.
Yeah, I mean, it seems the obvious response, right? I'm gonna work to their strengths and limit their weakness.
Yeah, and maybe that's what, you know, they saw start to wane a little bit for Bobby, is, you know, his physicality, and so they, to minimize that weakness, not saying he's a weak player, of course, but was to cover up offensive linemen. But yeah, it just, like I said, maybe came at the expense of others. I wasn't quite sure what he was saying about the coverage there, because if you're zoning off the crossing patterns, then what happens when the guy runs through the zone?
Yeah, he was on the beach, man. He could have been, you know, sipping Mai Tais. Well, you're not sure.
Hey, he knows football. Trust me. Maybe it was just miscommunication there. I wasn't quite sure what he was getting at. But
yeah, all right. We'll come back. We're going to talk some more football with the professor, John Clayton. He's going to join us next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.